You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy birthday, Charles Darwin. Born this day, February 12th, 1809.
So how old would he be right now if he were still alive?
202 years old.
Yeah. Oh.
He'd have some hip and joint problems.
Just yesterday.
Think, but he'd be sharp as ever, eh?
He'd have some incredibly short telomeres.
Bob.
Jesus, get into his personal life like that.
Just saying.
Good old Charlie Darwin.
Chuck to his friends.
So let's go on to some news items. The first news item is about processed food and IQ. This is one of those stories that we get tons of email on. It's been making its way around the mainstream media, often reported as eating a healthful diet increases IQ, or the other way around, that processed foods reduces IQ.
What is the exact definition of processed foods? Because I just got a food processor, and I love processing the ever-loving crap out of every food in my kitchen.
Yeah, that is a good question, and that is at the heart of one of my objections to this concept is the notion that what is processed food, and lumping it together into one category like that doesn't necessarily make any sense. But generally speaking, the term is used to refer to food that is not like whole food that you cook yourself, but something that is sort of pre-mixed and cooked. It's like if you buy a TV dinner or like a Hot Pocket, right, would be processed food.
Right. So Rebecca, you have a food manipulator.
Yeah. That makes it sound dirty. I'm going to go manipulate me some hummus.
I would like extend that definition by saying that like bleached flour or something that's had a lot of salt added to it, like anything that really isn't the way it was naturally.
But this is partly the naturalistic fallacy that, mm-hmm. As stuff comes out of the ground, it's somehow better than if you manipulate it in some way. And it's also a false dichotomy because it's a continuum. There's a continuum from eating something literally unaltered the way it is picked, in nature versus What about if you chop it up? What if you cook it a little bit? What if you mix it with something else? I mean, there's all different degrees of altering, of cooking, of processing food. So it is more of a continuum. But at the processed end of the spectrum, where you're buying food that's been significantly altered to the point where, the contents have been specifically manipulated, in order to create a product that is that is marketable, for example. So, if you're manipulating the amount of fat and sugar and salt that's in the end product, that's processed food, basically.
Can we all agree that a Twinkie is probably the most processed a food can get?
So, definitely, yeah. Twinkie is processed food.
Actually, Twinkie gets a bad rap. A lot of people think that Twinkies will last beyond the apocalypse, but in fact, Twinkies have an expiration date that is normally just a month or so after being baked.
Well, I guess for human consumption, Twinkies. Zombies will eat anything.
Well, aren't there Twinkie trees? Don't they get it from trees? Oh, man, that stinks.
Oh, wow.
It's really? True. They do. They are harvested.
So you want to get to this actual study? So this is an epidemiological study where they basically looked at 3 to 8-year-olds and they queried them as to their diet and sorted them into three categories. High in processed food, high in traditional food like meat and potatoes, and then a healthy, conscious diet like salads and fish. And then they found that there was a slight decrease in IQ at age 8 in the group that ate a lot of processed food compared to the other two. Slight being a few IQ points.
Was this controlled for income?
Yeah, so it was controlled for the basic stuff. It was controlled for socioeconomic status, level of education of the parents, and breastfeeding, because breastfeeding also can affect nutrition. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. So while they controlled for the obvious things like that, This is an observational study. It's an epidemiological study. It's not experimental. So there's a thousand things that they didn't control for. So, for example, it's, you know, easy to speculate about confounding factors here. Like, well, maybe parents who feed their kids lots of processed food don't have time to spend with them, to spend quality time with them. That's why they're allowing them to eat processed food rather than cooking or whatever. Or maybe parents who allow their kids to eat a lot of processed food are more permissive.
Maybe they just hate their kids.
Whatever. I mean, it could just be a marker for other behavior, and it's really the other behavior which is having the influence on IQ.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, right? So you just can't draw any conclusions from a single observational study like this. But also, it's a tiny effect, you know, just a few points. So it could also just be random
noise.
It could just be noise.
But have there been studies that show that better nutrition as a child can improve IQ later in life?
So that's absolutely true. So the plausibility here is that good nutrition, especially when you're young and developing, definitely has an impact on, you know, pretty much anything you care to measure later on, intelligence, size. Then the subsequent question is a diet high in processed food lack nutrition compared to these other diets? And that's where I think, you know, things get a little iffy. The problem with processed food, generally speaking, is that it contains too much of stuff. Either it's too much fat or too much salt, and not that it will cause malnutrition. And also, you know, in a Western industrialized nation, malnutrition is generally not a problem. So they didn't demonstrate that kids who were eating a highly processed diet were malnourished. So that would certainly be more information that would be helpful in trying to assess what the study is actually saying. Is it really causative, or is it just a marker for something else that has nothing to do with nutrition?
So the correct thing to do from here is to come up with better studies, more concrete studies?
Yeah, I think that you would like to verify the results of this study, first of all, because it's a small effect, and again, it could just be noise. And if it holds up, you want to look at it from multiple different angles, to test the various hypotheses, try to control for more variables, like parental time, for example, or whatever. Just anything you could think of that would be another factor. And then also see if there are other markers, to see if nutrition is causative, or there are other markers that go along with that.
Steve, we're talking about a few points here. It's not significant at all.
Yeah, it's a small effect. It's a very small effect. So, but you know, it's easy to give processed food a bad rap. You know, and a lot of the media just went for that, the quickie processed food and lower IQ, you know, but and I'm not defending, again, like the food industry or processed foods per se. I think that the industry generally does, you know, use inexpensive ingredients when they can get away with it, and they will, you know, you put lots of fat and calories in there or carbs, whatever it takes to make it tasty and not necessarily healthful. And it's only going to get better if, you know, there's a lot of consumer demand for more healthy products. But I don't think there's anything inherently unhealthy about the act of processing food. I just think it's what the industry chooses to put in there. And probably, from what I've been reading, the biggest problem is just is two things. I would say one is the high salt content. People are getting much more salt than they need. And the other one is the stealth calories. Mm-hmm. The fact that people get many more calories than they realize in a lot of processed food. I don't think that poor nutrition is necessarily a consequence of eating processed food. Now, you know, quote unquote junk food is different. Like if you're living on Twinkies, that's not a good idea.
Agreed.
Yep.
Let's go on. We have another IQ story, actually. Bob, you can tell us about bacterial IQ.
Yeah, this was pretty cool, and I learned a lot in the course of researching this. Scientists have developed an IQ test for bacteria and have discovered a couple of species of bacteria that are geniuses. Are not compared to us, well, most of us, but compared to their other single-cell brethren. These guys are definitely way off the scale. Now, Professor Eshel Ben-Jacob of Tel Aviv University's Department of Physics and Astronomy and his research student have led an international team of scientists in their research of probably my new favorite bacteria, Penicillin vortex, or P. vortex for short. Professor Ben-Jacob,
what was your old favorite bacteria?
Radiodurans, but this one I think might take the cake.
You didn't think he was going to have an answer for that, did you?
I just checking. That's all.
Bob, to clarify right up front, we're talking about the collective intelligence of colonies of bacteria, right? Not individual bacteria.
Yes, right. Okay. Right. Right. So a quote from this guy, Ben Jacobs, said, bacteria are our worst enemies, but they can also be our best friends. I agree with that.
Actually, can I just interject?
Yeah.
Most bacteria are neither. They're quite neutral to humanity. They are neither our friends nor our enemies. A small percentage are pathological, and a small percentage are beneficial. Yeah,
throw this study out.
And the rest don't give a crap about us. Just to throw it out there.
True, but they're not only just beneficial. I mean, I don't think that's a strong enough word. They are critical to pretty much life as we know it. So, yeah, they are key. To finish his quote, he said that to better exploit their capabilities and to outsmart pathogenic bacteria, we must realize their social intelligence. Now, by social intelligence, they're talking about essentially their interactions with the environment and each other. So that's kind of exactly what they mean when they say social intelligence. Now, this guy, Ben Jacob, discovered P. vortex 20 years ago, but now that he's got the new genetic tools at his command that we have today, he and his team were the first to sequence P. vortex. And during this study, while they were sequencing this guy or these guys, they developed their first ever bacteria social IQ score. They derived the score from basically an assessment of the genes in the bacteria arsenal and that allow them to communicate and process information about their surrounding environment and doing the things that they do to make their little bacterial decisions. The IQ is also based on the chemicals that the bacteria can synthesize for offense and defense. Most bacteria, especially and luckily our everyday pathogenic bacteria, are pretty stupid. Well, maybe they're not stupid, but they're only average, like the ones we've all heard, Streptococcus, Staphylococcus.
E. coli.
That joke is too easy. E. coli, Salmonella, P. vortex, on the other hand, they are apparently very good at taking tests. If you compare them to all the 500 of the different bacteria that's been sequenced, these guys are just crazy smart. The scientists try to compare them to human IQs, which I think is risky and problematic. If the average species of bacteria has a social IQ of say 100, then the P. vortex is 160, which or three standard deviations above normal, putting them in the relative range of an Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins.
They react and work in their environment more efficiently or faster or better than other bacteria, right?
Right. Just the way they interact and assess the environment around them is just astounding.
But is this the quantity, the way they quantify, is it basically the number of different behaviors that the bacteria can engage in?
No, now I wouldn't say the number, but just the complexity and sophistication of what they can do. For example, in a lot of ways, a colony can act like a multicellular organism because they'll have differentiated cells and they have tasks that are distributed between
them.
Sounds
like the Borg.
Oh man, in a lot of ways, yeah.
They're the Borg of bacteria.
I mean, they send out swarms of bacteria to seek out food and bring it back to them.
Wait, isn't there already a Borg of bacteria in Voyager? Come on, nerds. Come on, species 8675309 or something.
I never watched.
Yeah, I remember them. I loved watching them kick the Borg's ass. That was great.
See? Did I just out-dork you guys?
Yep.
What the hell?
It's an anomaly, but yeah, it happens. Also, these guys are just so awesome. The way even they communicate is amazing. The chemical communication that they engage in is so sophisticated. Scientists compare it to human linguistics in terms of semantics and other aspects of language. They could actually communicate to each other things like population size, environmental measurements at different locations. And the bottom line, though, just for this whole social IQ thing is that, I mean, it's not just, oh, wow, look at this cool species of bacteria. But I mean, we could learn a lot from them in terms of we can learn about new antibiotics. We can create these new powerful bacteria-based green pesticides for the agricultural industry. So a lot of benefits from this.
Sounds like you're saying they have a social network of certain kinds. I wonder if they have something like Facebook, bacteria book, pseudopod.
Well, yeah, but they all under relationship. It's all just asexual.
Yeah. Yeah, the relationship status still asexual.
Cares? It's complicated, but it's still complicated. Asexual.
They all have the same Facebook picture.
Yeah.
You know what? That's bigoted, Jay. They don't all look alike.
They can tell each other apart.
Exactly. tagged you on this slide.
How do you unfriend these guys? Yeah.
Instead of groups, it's just petri dishes. That's all I got. I'm out. I'm done.
Their Twitter must be boring as hell.
Don't poke me too hard. You break my membrane.
Jay, you're going to tell us about a skin cell spray gun.
Well, other doctors have developed spray-on skin devices, like Dr. Fiona Wood of the West Australia Burns Unit. And she did successfully treat a lot of people. One of the flaws of their original design, which I think they did this around 2000, was that it damaged some of the skin cells when they apply them because of the way that they spray them on. But this recent development has greatly increased the success rate of these treatments. So let me give you some background. Just we'll talk about burns real quick. So burns are usually treated with skin grafts. And this is where they take healthy skin and then they graft it to the injured part of the body. And burns are also treated the same way with skin that's grown artificially. And that's really cool. We've actually figured out a way to grow sheets of skin in the lab. And then what they would do is they would take that artificial skin. It's actually real skin, but it just wasn't grown on a human body. And then they would use that the same way that they would use a skin graft, and arguably not as effectively just because of how fragile they are. And also people that get real skin grafts or grown skin grafts, those types of treatments are actually prone to infection because, yeah, your skin is your body's first line of defense against infection. So if you have a significant wound or you've burned yourself significantly, then your body can't fend off a bacteria or virus in the same way. So that's, unfortunately, people that get burned also have to deal with massive infections. Another problem with growing skin in a lab is that it takes weeks to grow. And like I said, this skin is very fragile. So they would take a sample of somebody's skin. They would use that to grow skin. And then, you know, that patient has to wait weeks before they could do anything for them. And then when they apply these grafts, sometimes fluid from the skin can build up under them. And this could damage the skin graft. Just lots of different problems with this process. Professor Gerlach and his team at the Department of Surgery at the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine in Pittsburgh, developed the treatment in 2008, and his new system uses a method that is an electronically controlled pneumatic device that, unlike previous systems, doesn't damage the skin cells that they literally shoot onto the patient. So a biopsy is taken from the patient's undamaged skin. What they do is there are healthy stem cells in this skin. Those are isolated. They're dissolved in water, and then they spray it on the burn. And it sprays it on, of course, you know, they do it as evenly as they can. And the wounded skin is then covered with a dressing that has two sets of tubes embedded in it. And this is the technology that really makes this process work very well. The two sets of tubes that are embedded in the dressing, one of them acts as an artery and the other acts as a vein. And what this system does is it provides electrolytes, antibiotics, amino acids, and glucose to the wound. So it does two things. It keeps the wound sterile and provides the skin with the nutrition it needs to grow. So it's basically, you know, taking this new skin that they've moved from another part of the body. They've evenly distributed these stem cells over the burned area. Then they're protecting it in a way that skin grafts can't function. And it's feeding the skin. So the skin grows very rapidly. And guess how many days it takes for this treatment to, you know, I wouldn't like say cure someone of the wound, but basically get them to a very healthy state where they're not prone to infection anymore. It's like basically 3 days.
From what though? From a weeks? Second degree, third degree?
It's only second degree.
Fourth degree?
They can't do third degree burns yet. They're working on that. You know, the difference between a second degree and a third degree burn is pretty significant. But this works on second degree burns. The idea here is though, guys, that we're talking about treating people in days instead of weeks. And I'm sure Steve knows this, but burn victims are in enormous pain and the recovery is long. And long after they get out of the hospital, they could be debilitated.
What do you think hurts more, second degree or third degree burns?
Probably second degree. Third degree actually burns the nerves, so you don't feel it anymore, right?
That's right. Yeah, kills all the nerves.
I've had second degree burns. They are nasty.
I saw a video.
That really stings.
I saw a video of a guy that got treated with this process. They've treated dozens of people successfully so far. And I'm telling you, the guy had the pictures of his hand. What he, the second degree burns of what he had sustained from a he was standing near a fire at a party and someone threw a cup of gasoline and of course you know things went wrong and he got severely burned. But they showed his skin 3 days after treatment and guys, it looked almost normal. Like you really have to look closely to say, oh, maybe that's not really that normal. I mean, it's phenomenal how well this process works.
Yeah, it seems like a really good approach, you know, basically evenly spreading stem cells and letting them reproduce, you know, where they're going to ultimately be rather than trying to lay a delicate sheet of skin cells onto the burned skin, the burned tissue, and have, you know, then you have all those problems that are inherent to that. So this seems like a superior approach, and it's good that they, you know, got over those technical hurdles and made it work. It's great.
And one more quick interesting fact that in 2008, this research was funded by the U.S. Department of Defense under the Armed Forces Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And this was created specifically to research better ways to treat wounded service personnel.
War is generally very good for emergency and trauma medicine.
Testing things out. Yeah.
Think about how much, you know, trauma you deal with in a war situation, you know.
And also how much money the military has to spend on endeavors like this.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Most, maybe not most, but a ton of our current present-day technology that we use in our everyday lives is only possible because of military applications.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, ideally, of course, we'd love to say, hey, let's not spend any money on war and spend all of our money on technology, and we'd have a lot more stuff. But, you know, at the very least, the military does spend money in ways that people do eventually benefit from in regards to health and you know, things like this. When I read this article, and I always love things like this because you could just really see technology coming alive and helping people. And this is where Carl Sagan said, science delivers the goods. And this is something, no matter how hard homeopaths or chiropractors would dare try to say that anything that they do can achieve great ends, this is something that's phenomenal. This is a true...
Now, hold on, Jay. You're telling me that, you know, that a pseudoscientist like a homeopath wouldn't claim to treat something as obviously traumatic as a burn? Is that what you're saying?
No, but if you have a headache or depression, Steve, they're on it.
Hang on.
I have something to say about that, actually.
Yeah, Rebecca might have something to add to that. What do you think about, Rebecca?
Well, it's funny we should be talking about quacks trying to treat emergency trauma. This is a really depressing story, so I hope everyone enjoyed the awesome story of the skin gun, because things are about to get really sad. A 16-year-old boy near Philadelphia was injured while wrestling in a wrestling practice. He butted heads with another student, and he was left with some severe spinal damage. He went to the hospital, to Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where doctors attempted to immobilize him and prepare him for surgery in order to hopefully save him from the possibility of being a quadriplegic for the rest of his life. His mother, unfortunately, is a naturopath. We talk a lot about people using quack medicine, alternative medicine, to treat serious diseases. But as mentioned, rarely is it quite so absurd as in this case, because the doctors attempted to explain to the mother and the son that were he to move around, he could risk severely damaging his spine again and make the problem much worse. However, the mother began fighting for the right to take her son home so that he could be treated with herbs. Herbs and spices.
Herbs are going to cure him?
Yes.
Yeah.
According to this woman, Vermel Mitchell, she has a degree in naturopathy from Trinity School of Natural Healing, and ORAC wrote a complete takedown of this case on Respectful Insolence. He describes how she, how her school offers courses such as a Master of Iridology which is the crazy thing that you know you can diagnose illness based on just the eyes, things like that. So, and also an associate degree in Bible studies, a certified health specialist. They teach homeopathy. Basically, the full range of quackery is taught at the school. And she buys into it all, and apparently she's raised her son to buy into it all as well, because he supported her decision to take him home, despite being told that it could possibly leave him paralyzed. Luckily, I suppose, the courts intervened, and Delaware County attempted to gain temporary custody of the teenager. They just the other day, I believe, they were granted temporary custody, and so the boy, whose name is Maserati, by the way, I'm just going to set that down and walk away because this is a very tragic thing, and I don't want to joke about it. But that's his name. So Maserati is now still in the hospital awaiting treatment, and the mother is trying to get a lawyer to appeal, I believe. So it's a really tricky case because the kid is 16, which means he's right on the cusp of being able to decide these things for himself. He's right on the cusp of adulthood.
Yeah.
And, you know, we grant a lot of powers to 16-year-olds. And, you know, a 16-year-old can really decide for himself what's going to happen to him. So this isn't just a case of, you know, a very young child whose opinions on his own medical treatment don't matter. So on the one hand, you do, I think there is a natural desire to want this near adult to make decisions for himself. But on the other hand, this is so incredibly insane and damaging, that it's, you know, you can really see the purpose, I think, of wanting to intervene. And even if he was a full grown adult over the age of 18, I think that it would be, I don't know, I can kind of see the benefit of intervening because he obviously doesn't understand.
Though. I mean, once you're a legal adult, you have the right to refuse even common sense, life-saving medical care. It's just,
unless you declare them to be insane. Right. And that's what I'm saying about this, is that this, to me, and I suppose on a basic level, it's just the same as someone thinking that homeopathy can cure their cancer. It's, you know, just as effective, I suppose. But on another level, it is to me really just incredibly insane to believe that herbs can somehow fix you when you're just by moving, you are risking paralyzing yourself. I mean, they're not campaigning against some sort of Western drug in this case. It's, although I should note, and ORAC notes, that she's also resisting the use of steroids on the boy. And ORAC points out that that could be a good move because the use of steroids in cases like this hasn't been proven to have much of an effect. But in the case of resisting just keeping the kid locked down so that he doesn't re-injure himself, that to me passes some sort of line in the sand. That to me crosses over into pure insanity.
But unfortunately, the definition of being impaired does not include making a horrifically bad decision. You know, you have to actually like not understand the consequences of your decisions. I mean, the criteria are pretty extreme.
But doesn't that? I mean, isn't that the definition of not understanding the consequences? I mean, you know, clearly there's no way that either of them can understand the consequences if they're ready to move someone with a severe spinal injury.
Yeah, but believing in magic, unfortunately, is not enough. So like, if you're an adult and you say, I'm going to pray and that's going to magically make me better, that, you know, to a rational person that may seem crazy, but that doesn't buy you the legal definition of impaired or incompetent.
Yeah. And even I should mention that I get the, you know, the desire to also fight for an individual's freedom of choice. So to me it's just a really sticky, ugly, depressing case.
But what can be done, guys? You know, it's one thing to respect people's freedom to make these types of choices. And, you know, of course, we're all having that dilemma where we're saying, well, it's in the 16-year-old's best interest, but it's, you know, but we can't take their rights away, you know, even if it's in their best interest, which is, that's something else that needs to be discussed, because we do have seatbelt laws and speed limit laws and all sorts of stuff like that. But what they could do is make it required for them to, like, witness study results and video, and, you know, maybe, you know, give them an education on what they're about to be doing. You know, what
you could offer that to them, but you can't force it on them. I mean, it's,
well, why? Why, you know,
yeah,
why
you can't
ship them off to a re-education center?
No, right? Why? You know, why can't we be prepared for circumstances like this? It's not like, you know,
a re-education center. It's a critical thinking center.
Yeah, I use that term deliberately. I mean, the point is, you cross over a certain fuzzy line where you start to have, you know, a 1984 kind of fascist state, and we just decide that, you know, despite the fact that you know, it means people are going to make horrific decisions for themselves, we err on the side of personal freedom. And that's the decision we've made as a culture, as a society. I think it's reasonable. I think it's reasonable to have the, you know, the exception for kids. I think if you're underage, you know, then no, you can't make horrific decisions for yourself, and your parents can't abuse you by making horrific decisions for you either. And I think that's all a reasonable compromise. It's tremendously frustrating when somebody is making these kind of decisions. The real culprit here is the fact that we allow this system of completely nonsensical and unscientific medicine to exist in our society.
Yeah, I agree with that, of course. But there isn't a way to completely solve that issue, especially quickly enough, Steve. And
there isn't, and certainly there's no quick fix, but this is just one example of why it does matter. When people say, what's the harm if people want to believe in this frou-frou stuff like homeopathy or herbal medicine or whatever? Well, this is the harm.
This is it.
It teaches people to believe in nonsense, and that's very, very dangerous. All right, well, let's move on. Let's do a quick one. Evan, you're going to tell us about the UFO.
Oh.
Racist.
Oy vey.
Holy crap.
Who knew?
That was good.
This is the Jerusalem UFO, Steve, as you so so humorously pointed out.
Succinct. I was very succinctly.
It was the late evening or early morning of January 29th in which the supposed Jerusalem UFO footage occurred. So you have a wide shot at night of the Rock Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And all of a sudden, hovering over the dome of the Rock Temple Mount is a light. A light, which would, you know, I guess by comparison to the other things in the video, maybe, I don't know, be about maybe 10 feet long or so, a pretty small, yet pretty bright light. It's hovering there over the rock, over the dome of the Rock Temple Mount, hangs there in the air for a while, and then all of a sudden, flash, zooms up into the air. The camera follows it up, and it apparently disappears out of sight, and you can see some blinking red lights, as if there is a mothership or something equivalent hovering up just beyond the cloud line or something. Essentially to that effect. You can take a look online and see the Jerusalem UFO videos. There were two that were initially released, and then a few days later, a third came out. And then just recently, a day or two ago, a fourth video of this UFO sighting came out. So what's going on here?
What is this, aliens?
Probably aliens.
Could be aliens. Most of the panel guesses aliens. What is most likely going on here is a hoax.
Or a series of hoaxes.
Come on.
I know.
Evan.
It's not at all.
I was sure this was the time when a giant, brightly lit UFO flew over a major city and nobody reported it.
Right.
Until days later when somebody put an anonymous video up on YouTube. Because when we do encounter aliens, that's what it's going to be like, an anonymous video on YouTube with no other witnesses or information.
Yeah, I know, right? You know, thousands of people would have reported something like that.
That's right. This is not some remote area of Israel or something in the desert. This is Jerusalem. I mean, this is the hub of activity in which there are thousands of people around every night. Nobody else saw this. Got footage of it of any kind. Very suspicious. Also, nobody knows who exactly took the videos that went up onto YouTube. And there's a lot of problems with the actual video itself. The relatively small size of the alien. In three of the four videos, the lights all seem stationary except for the UFO light. There's unnatural acceleration of this object. There's no external noises that the object is making. It's certainly, you know, defying every law of
right. But physics. But even if you write all of that off of, that's just how the UFOs behave, right? They're silent. They defy physics. That's how we know they're alien technology, right? That's what a proponent would say. But if you look at these videos, again, we'll have the links, of course, on the notes page, it looks fake, right? It looks like CG. And you know
that's how aliens look.
Alien ships. I remember, like when I wrote about this, I was like, yeah, they just happen to look like whatever way you can fake them. So, like Billy Meyer had that video of the flying saucer, which was literally dangling pendulum like from a string,
like Ed Wood did in his movies back in the 40s.
And the proponent said, well, that's just how they move. Yeah, it's like, yeah, they use a pendulum drive.
Imagine these aliens come out of the spaceship and they're an 8-bit.
Yeah, they're an 8-bit. So now they apparently use CG drive or something. They move just like they would. Because you've seen enough CG now, but you know how like unnaturally uniform something that's moving on with computer graphics looks. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something unnatural about it. It's unnaturally straight and uniform and everything. Well, that's exactly what this looks like. It looks like something that was programmed on a computer. And again, it's a blob of light. It's not like a. You can see any kind of detail. But in one of the pictures, Evan, there's one where it's like a fairly close-up picture of the temple. And what I thought was interesting about this, I don't remember ever seeing this before. It was a video that was created using a still photograph as the background, right? And sort of zooming in on the photo as if you were zooming in on the scene. But of course, that creates anomalies. For example, all of the lights in the photo are stationary.
That's right.
The flares, you know, like the little star effect on all the lights. And if you were actually moving a camera around and zooming in and out, they would sparkle and rotate and instead, they're perfectly static. Well, let's move on to who's that noisy.
I'm going to play for you last week's noisy, and we'll see if you all remember this one.
First hawk, ergo proctor hawk.
Yeah, not much to go on there.
Nope, not much to go on. So you think anyone got that right?
Oh, my God. I saw the email.
Have we had as many emails as we did? I don't know that we've had as many emails about any one thing than we did on this noisy.
Yeah. I think I was trying to figure out why did so many people respond to this one. I think because a lot of people knew it and thought that other people wouldn't know it because it was tricky. So they thought, "Oh, I'm going to get this one right," but a ton of people knew this.
So that was the quote by that was quoted by actor Martin Sheen playing President Bartlett from The West Wing in season one. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never even watched West Wing, to tell you the truth.
Really?
Yeah, I randomly happened across that segment on YouTube, and it was actually quite random. I said that would be perfect. But a lot of our listeners apparently are very big West Wing listeners, watchers, and fans of the show. But none were faster than listener Patrick McComb, who emailed in first the correct answer. So congratulations, Patrick.
All right. Thanks, Evan. What do you got for this week?
All right. For this week? Okay. Try to identify this noisy.
Sounds like Jay.
It does sound a little like Jay.
No, it doesn't.
Do you guys have any idea what that might be?
So are you saying that was not a human being shouting in the background there?
Yeah, so that would be the hint for this week. That is not a human being.
Yeah, it's something else.
That is something else.
Okay.
All right.
Interesting.
So all right, Evan. That's this week's Who's That Noisy. Please post your messages on our forum or send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Jeff Ainsley. Jeff, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Jeff is one of the hosts of Fat to Fit Radio, a weight loss and fitness podcast. How long have you been doing that?
We've been doing the show about 3.5 years. When we started the show, my co-host was about 100 pounds overweight, and after 3.5 years, he's finally lost his 100 pounds. So it's been a process of following him as he loses the weight, and now we're finally getting there, and now it's maintenance and just living this healthy lifestyle.
That's a good idea. We should have done that 4 or 5 years ago, Steve. One of us should have been like a true believer, and we just should have like slowly converted one of us into a skeptic.
Jeff, are you the reason why your co-host had such a success?
Well, I think it's partially. I found out about him because he had another podcast earlier about weight loss, and he lost, I think it was 60 pounds really quick. And I was listening to this because I had gained some weight and I was looking for inspiration. And he stopped telling people how much weight he had lost week after week. And I knew it was happening. So I basically sent him an email and said, hey, I can help you out. He said, hey, do you want to start a new podcast? And that was the start of Fat to Fit Radio. And he finally lost all the weight slowly and hopefully he's going to keep it off.
That's funny you say that because, you know, I have so many friends who have gone through that too, where as they're losing weight, they're advertising the success of their weight loss, and then you just stop hearing about it after a while. You know, they just stop telling everybody about their weight, and then when you see them, you know, they've gained it back or more. So unfortunately, that's a common pattern with weight loss, right? Most people who lose weight on a quote-unquote diet are destined to gain it back, right?
And really, the statistics are in the high 90% people who gain back all of their weight, plus a little more within 2 years. Some of the best statistics out there are from Weight Watchers, and I found some internal studies that they did in Weight Watchers, and of the people who are their lifetime members and who've managed to keep off their weight for 5 years, it's only about 35%, and these are the people that are still involved and going to all of the regular meetings. That's not a huge success rate.
Oh, wow.
And it's a pretty big commitment, too. I mean, these are the people who are committed, who are going to meetings, and it's part of their life.
That's right. So they're not including all the people who try it for a year or two and give up and gain their weight back. They're not even counting those people in those stats.
And Jeff, listening to some of your shows, Weight Watchers, aren't they like the probably best diet centers that are out there? All the other ones even are just far, far worse in terms of actually the plan that they make you use to lose the weight and,
Well, it depends what you consider to be the best. They're definitely the biggest out there, and they're a major conglomerate. But when you look at different countries, we get emails from Australia and UK, and they have totally different centers that seem to be popular there. But the industry as a whole is just worth billions and billions of dollars. And it's really the only industry that gets bigger and bigger and never succeeds at what they're trying to sell. Mm-hmm. If you think about look at people learning how to read, for example. If the literacy rates were only 66% and going lower and lower year after year, and people are investing more money, you'd have to think there's something wrong with all of these diet centers.
Yeah, and it's not just the diet centers. I think it's also the self-help industry for weight loss, which I also find ironic that every type of fad diet makes the argument, well, these other diets don't work because they've been around for years and Americans are still getting fatter. Meanwhile, of course, their diet's been around for years also. I think the entire weight loss industry gets chalked up as a failure, don't you think?
Oh, I totally agree with you. And if you look at the current diet books right now, they're going into a trend where they are trying to look for scientific evidence. They're all going to point out things like, oh, it's your blood type that's important, or it's leptin or ghrelin. It's those types of hormones that are causing you to be fat. And they all have really convincing studies. But if you look at these books side by side, one of them has to be totally wrong, or they're both wrong.
You know, one observation I made, guys, is that the fact is lots of people are having a tremendous amount of success by dieting, by doing some type of calorie restrictive diet. The fact is, the real problem is that they can't maintain
right.
it. So I put it to you guys, and Jeff, I'm sure that you have come to some type of conclusion like this already. that dieting does work and exercise does work. It's being able to incorporate that into your lifestyle and having some type of sustainability that's the real issue here.
Well, you're right in that exercise and reducing calories does help you lose weight, but you also have the word lifestyle, and the problem is people can't put it together. The problem with a diet is people go on as a temporary thing and then they go off the diet. Our whole concept of our show is that you look at your goal weight and you look at that person, you figure out how much that person eats and exercises, and then you start eating that right now, and then eventually you become that person, so you never go off the diet. So I guess to say it simply, you start to live the lifestyle of that thinner person and you will become that person.
So let's get to some of the most common weight loss myths. Obviously, there's a huge industry of weight loss, either self-help or products. They have to sell something to people. You can't just keep telling people the same few basic truths over and over again, so that everyone has to have their gimmick. And let's start with what I consider to be the most common one, and that is that the macronutrient ratios are the secret to losing weight. What do you think about those claims?
Well, it's definitely true that they went through phases of this. They had the high carbohydrate diets with all vegetables, etc., and the low carb diets that started with the Atkins diet and everything in between. And really, that is the difference between the programs when you look at it. There's really not much else between these programs. It's all macronutrients and how much you eat of each one and how often, etc.
Do you think there's anything to the low carb diets or any of those diets based upon macronutrients?
Well, there was a study that just came out this year that was talking about the low-carbohydrate diets, and it was a long-term study. I don't have the reference right in front of me, but it was about a 20-year study, and it showed that the mortality rates from all causes was a lot higher for people who are on these low-carb diets. You know, I've read the Dr. Atkins book, you know, The Atkins Diet at the Start from 1972, I think, and I was totally convinced that this was the way to live. But it takes 30 years of study and seeing what happens to people in the long term to see that it's what people thought. It is. It's just not as healthy as what he was claiming back in the 1970s. The truth is finally coming out.
So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that if you look at the basic science research, there's lots of interesting things going on in terms of the effects of carbohydrates and glycemic index and fat, et cetera. But if you look at the clinical data, just looking at what people are doing, there doesn't seem to be any benefit to adjusting your macronutrients, right? It's just it comes down to how much are you exercising and how much are you eating.
Well, Steve, I think people, sadly, are looking for the magic bullet. You know, they want the thing that's going to make it easy for them to lose weight. They don't want to feel hungry. You know, I know that I have a thing about, I know how to satisfy myself with food, and usually it involves overeating and I have to eat something sweet at the end. And that sounds funny, but it's true, right? Like, if I don't eat slow enough, I'm probably eating, you know, a lot more carbs than I should. And I get into like that, that sugar high thing, you know, where you're kind of hungry and then you're not, and then you eat a little more and you go get into like a cycle. And I find that when I eat smaller portions and take my time, I actually feel fuller, better for longer. So a lot of it is just behavioral changes that people get into. You know, they get into like a thing. Maybe they grow up in an environment where people overeat, and then it's stuck with them for the rest of their life. Or they're addicted to candy, and that's stuck with them for the rest of their life. They don't know how to break out of it.
And you also alluded to the fact that people get happiness out of eating, and they feel good, and they enjoy eating, and it does become an emotional issue. And losing weight's also an emotional issue because people reach a point where they're so unhappy with the way they look and the way they feel that they just want to jump into a diet and lose the weight as fast as they can, and they think that's just the best thing to do. They have so much pain that they think the pain of being on a really horrible, restrictive diet is not as much pain as being fat. And the problem is that generally hurts them in the long run. They gain more weight because they go off this diet and just pig out again to regain all this weight.
Jeff, what is a reasonable amount of fat loss that you should expect on a weekly basis?
Well, the safe levels, they always say 1 to 2 pounds or up to 1% of your body mass right now. Mm-hmm. The thing is, what you don't want to do is lose any lean body mass. When you lose lean body mass, that's what drives your metabolism, and that's what slows down your metabolism for people who lose weight. You don't want to lose 50 pounds and have to be eating like someone who's lost 100 pounds to maintain that weight loss. You want to eat the most amount of food that you can at any weight. You don't want to harm your metabolism no matter what. So that's what we consider safe weight loss, is just fat loss.
Absolutely.
Right. If you're losing more than, 2 pounds in a week, you're losing more than just fat.
Yeah, generally some, Water and muscle and water.
Yeah, water. And water is, you know, that's just fooling yourself, right? Just by, that makes the scale look better temporarily, but it's just water weight. But if you're losing muscle, then that's completely counterproductive because that's very metabolically active and it's also very healthy and aesthetically, you know, beneficial tissue to have, right? That's people. That's exactly what people don't want to do.
Oh, yeah.
When you look at the science, they say 1 pound of body fat burns about 4 calories per day, and a 1 pound of lean body mass or muscle burns about 14 or 15 calories. The thing is, that's when you're just sitting doing nothing all day. Muscle burns a lot more calories when you move, so they say a pound of muscle can be 30 to 50 calories when you add everything in. So by losing 2 or 3 pounds, maybe you have to eat 100 calories less per day, worst case scenario.
You know, Jeff, the way that you described lean muscle tissue, it kind of sounded like a machine that burns calories. You know, it's the more muscle mass you have, the more muscle you have to burn more calories.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's the main reason why diets fail, because people lose that muscle mass. I was just thinking, you guys talked about the Twinkie diet. Do you remember that a few months ago?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, the person who did this, he was on an 1,800 calorie per day diet. And after 10 weeks, he lost 27 pounds. I went to his personal blog and looked up all of his statistics where he put a lot more information. And of the 27 pounds, he lost 6 pounds of muscle mass. So 22% of his fat loss, supposedly, was just muscle loss. So 6 pounds, maybe he's damaged his metabolism 150 calories less. That means his 27-pound weight loss, he should be able to eat 150 calories more per day every day to stay there. Now he has to eat less. He's probably going to gain that weight back partially because of that.
Yeah. That's a lot of extra Twinkies he could have eaten every day. Wow.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone was saying that that's a good diet to be on or a good strategy for weight loss. It was really a stunt to prove a point that it's real. The weight change, not fat loss, but weight loss, is all about calories. There's an ad on the radio stations locally. I'm not sure how widespread these ads are, but it's for like a weight loss shake. Again, it's a gimmicky weight loss product. And the guy who's selling it, there's two versions of the commercial. In one commercial, he makes like the outrageous claim that if you ate less than 1,000 calories a day, you'd still gain weight. Unless you were, you know, quote unquote, feeding your body right, which means buying his product and eating his shakes. Yeah. So it's like, well, how can he lie like that? I mean, it's just flat out completely incorrect. You could eat less than 1,000 calories a day and still gain weight? No. Now, even if you're in a coma, you'll gain weight. You'll lose weight, rather, on less than 1,000 calories a day.
Yeah, that's dangerous as hell. It's lower than your BMR, your basal metabolic rate. You'll be losing muscle left and right. Nasty.
So the Twinkie diet counteracts that kind of nonsense, you know, but it obviously wasn't meant to be like this is a healthful diet.
Well, that just focuses in on the importance of not weight loss. People say, oh, how much weight did you lose? Or look at all this weight I lost. Weight shouldn't be what your focus is. Like we said, it should be the fat and not the muscle. And you got to design your activities and your diet around making sure that you're losing fat.
Oh, that's totally right. Who cares what you weigh? Are you going to go out in public and bring a scale with you to set it down to say, see, I hit 150 pounds. Look at me. No one does that. They care about your circumference measurements. You know, get a tape measure, measure yourself, compare that week to week, because that's what you're trying to do is get smaller, not to weigh less. And another thing, it's all about body fat percentage. Mm. We say to go for a BMI of 25. Now, 25 BMI is supposedly the upper range of healthy. It's not good for the individual, but it's just a starting point. Once you start to approach that, then you look at your body fat percentage to get you right into your landing zone here. And they say for acceptable weight, it's the 25%. So for men, if you're below 25% in there, that's acceptable. And for women, if you're just a little bit above 25%, it's acceptable. And those are just kind of the ballpark terms there.
All right. So Jeff, for the average listener out there who, let's say, has got 20 or 30 pounds of weight that they want to lose, they're inundated with misinformation and, you know, gimmicky claims about fad diets, et cetera, and scientific sounding information about glycemic index and whatnot. We're basically, so far we've been saying that's all nonsense. It's not really science-based. What's the few things that somebody should do? What's a basic, you know, you already stated your philosophy, but give us some like nuts and bolts about what people should be focusing on if they want to maintain a healthy weight.
Well, the big thing is eating throughout the day, not starving, not skipping breakfast. It's eating smaller meals, 5 or 6 meals or 3 meals and 2 snacks. It's not drastically cutting your calories. It's doing something that you can go on for a lifetime or year after year and not even think that you're dieting. The goal is really to lose the weight the same way that you gained the weight. When people gain weight, they're not all bloated and feeling all unhappy and, you know, this is just horrible. You can lose weight the same way and just try on a pair of pants and all of a sudden they're a bit too loose. You know, it's the same way when you tried those pants on and they were too tight. Losing weight doesn't have to be a horrible experience to go through. It can be gradual and work. And people get so caught up in all the little intricacies, like Steve, you were saying about the high glycemic index. If you just eat mainly all natural, unprocessed foods and you watch the amount that you eat, you don't really have to worry about calories. You don't have to worry about supplements. Everything just comes together if you just live that sort of lifestyle.
So the question of what an individual should do, I think to me the literature is pretty clear. You know, it's overall calories. You know, you definitely want to – it's, you know, to some extent food quality. It's how much you exercise. But the harder question is to figure out why is it that as a society we're getting more and more overweight, and not just America but most Western industrialized nations are – you know, following in our footsteps in terms of obesity. Do you have a sense of the literature or your own, you know, biases and what you think may be the big factors for the obesity epidemic that we're in the middle of?
Well, there's a lot of different statistics that we go over all the time, you know, from the CDC and the OECD countries. And it seems that when fast food moves into countries, and not just fast food, but a lot of processed food, the cheap foods that we see in Walmart, for example, the obesity levels tend to go up quite quickly. We're seeing that right now in Mexico, for example. But then there's also studies within the United States that show it's an economic issue, and lower average economics means that people are heavier. There's also things that show that when women earn more income, they're thinner, but the opposite is true for the men. The more income they earn, they're actually fatter.
So do you think it's more that we're consuming more calories because we're consuming more processed and fast foods? Is that the big factor?
Statistically, you can see the statistics for the amount of average calories that have been produced per country, and then you divide it by the population. And the calories have definitely gone up 500 or 600 calories per day over about the last 20 years. So at least the food is being produced. We can't say that all of that's being eaten, but it is being produced, and the average calories means people are eating more food, and it's just common sense. It's not a huge secret as to what's going on when you just look at the numbers.
And what about the degree of the level of exercise? I mean, the other side of the coin is that some people will blame it on a sedentary society, which, again, makes sense, and you could blame it on video games and computers, but I haven't seen the data to really support that.
Well, the daily activity is definitely going down. Now, I'm a phys ed teacher in Canada, and Canada is just announcing that they're going to lower their recommended daily activity simply because they realized that if they set the level too high, people just won't even try to attain it, which I think is pretty sad, but I guess they have to get people moving somehow, even to whatever level they can.
So they're basically just giving up and saying, all right, let's just move a little bit. You know, forget about what's really a reasonable goal. We want you to just – they're choosing an attainable goal rather than the optimal goal.
I see that so many places in society. You look at the airline seats that are getting wider because of the pressures of larger passengers. You look at the pressure on the automobile industry to have larger test crash dummies because, you know, larger people are getting more injured because the seatbelts won't hold them back. And every time that something like this accommodates – I guess in me, I feel so disappointed because I'd rather people get thinner and healthier, not just to keep accommodating and accommodating. And the thing about lowering activity levels, that actually really did bother me.
You do have to consider the fact that our bodies do have a regulatory mechanism by which they do regulate
set point,
our hunger. Yeah, and it's amazing how you think about over the course of a year, if you gain 1 pound over the course of a year, but that means, you know how closely you matched your caloric intake and output over the course of a year?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's got to be because there's a self-regulatory mechanism. And the bottom line is it's not easy to gain that system. It just isn't. It's not. You can't fool it just by drinking diet soda or you know, macronutrient adjustments, whatever. It's not easy to do that. And I get the feeling that we really haven't cracked this nut yet. We're not really, we can point to factors that correlate and whatnot, but we have to learn more about, you know, how to really influence that system so that people, without the Herculean effort that nobody can sustain, right? That's the big problem with diets. Just if once you get beyond a certain threshold of effort, nobody can sustain it, or very, very few people can. We need to figure out a way that it becomes easy for people to manipulate that system so that, you know, people are maintained at a more healthful weight. And I honestly just don't think we've cracked that nut yet.
That's true. Everyone can lose weight by following a diet, or they can lose weight by gradually reducing their what they're eating and how much, and increasing what they're exercising. But the bottom line is, how are you going to make people do it without trying to force societal change? You want to make being fat counterculture, which is opposite of what it is right now. That's a huge turnaround for the entire society.
Yep, I agree. So, Jeff, where can people check out your website, your podcast, your book?
Well, the website is fattofitradio.com. That's with the number 2. And we also have a book out, The Fat to Fit, Getting There and Staying There. We basically did our first 100 episodes like an educational series where we had homework and reviews, etc. And when we got to 100 episodes, we thought we had all of these hundreds of pages of notes. We might as well put it together in a book. And that way, people who don't really listen to podcasts can actually get something in their hands and read through it as well.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, it was fun, guys.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious. I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to sniff out the fake. There is a theme this week.
Ugh.
In honor of Charles Darwin, the theme is evolution.
Oh, boy.
Boo.
You guys ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Here we go. Item number 1. X-ray studies of an ancient snake fossil reveal a hidden vestigial leg and support the hypothesis that modern snakes evolved from lizard ancestors. Item number 2. A newly discovered fossil reveals a 100 million-year-old carnivorous cricket that was as large as a domestic cat. And item number 3, scientists report that the animal with the most genes discovered so far is a tiny, almost microscopic crustacean, the water flea, with 31,000 genes. Rebecca, since you booed, you get to
no.
go
first.
Come on, your majesty.
Don't you know you have to remain totally silent?
I don't want to go first, because I've had a really hard week. My laptop blew up, and I haven't been online, and I don't... All right. Wait, now Jay is writing stuff and I can't see the items anymore. All right. So, modern snakes evolved from lizards. Yeah, why not? Sure. Hidden vestigial leg. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Because, yeah, they could have had the legs and then they didn't need them anymore. And there are those... there's lizards, there's legless lizards. That's a thing. 100 million-year-old carnivorous cricket as large as a cat. See, now, I know that Steve doesn't do LSD, so...
How do you know?
Because Steve doesn't do any drugs. Steve is what we call a teetotaler.
That's right.
And therefore, I believe that that one might be true, because I don't think that Steve could have come up with that sans... serious psychoactive psychedelic drugs. Anyway, scientists report that the animal with the most genes is the water flea with 31,000 genes. I guess I don't, that seems like a lot of genes, but I don't know. I don't know how many genes is a lot of genes. This sucks. I'll just go with whatever Bob says.
You can't do that. GWB.
Can you do that?
There's no rules here. No
way.
Do you have a get out of science or fiction free card?
Yeah, I'd like to phone a friend, and I want that friend to be Bob. Bob, which one are you going to go with?
Sorry, Rebecca.
All right, I'm going to say that the snakes evolving from lizard ancestors, because that's the one that makes the most sense to me, is probably going to be the fiction, because... Steve wants us to think he's going to zig, and then he zags. I believe this is a zag.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, Evan?
Scientists reporting the animal with the most genes discovered has 31,000 genes, and it's a water flea. I mean, that's remarkable. Equally, if not more remarkable, is a supposed 100-million-year-old carnivorous cricket as large as a domestic cat. Bet you they found that in China. Like so many fossils and things they're finding nowadays. 100 million years old, though. Carnivorous cricket. Were cricket-like things around 100 million years ago? Does that seem a bit long, Bob? Yeah, you think it's a bit long.
Hmm?
Yeah, I know what you're thinking.
No,
so I'm having an issue with that one. And then,
don't try to do the Jedi mind trick on Bob.
You're right. It only works 60% of the time. The first one, Steve, about the X-ray studies of the snake fossil, revealing the hidden vestigial leg. Sorry, Rebecca. I think that one's science, and I'm having a hard time with this 100-million-year-old carnivorous cricket. I just think that's too far back for something cricketish. So I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. The vestigial legs on an ancient snake. I mean, yeah. I mean, that just seems so, yeah, so obvious. Maybe too obvious. What am I missing here? I'm trying to think of what did snakes even evolve from lizards? Maybe it was a completely different line. I do remember seeing in a reptile and amphibian book a really cool image of what looks like a snake, a clear snake. And this is a modern animal that exists now. It looks like a snake, but it's got legs. It's clearly got these tiny, tiny legs. And it's, I think it's some type of lizard, but it's just a really weird-looking thing. So that was just completely unrelated.
Can't trust photos.
The carnivorous cricket, too. I mean, I could just see that as being either way. I can go totally either way on that as well. I mean, yeah, at first when I was thinking as big as a domestic cat, yeah, right. But, I mean, 100 million years ago, wasn't the oxygen content of the atmosphere a lot higher, which supported much bigger insects? Like dragonflies were, like, bigger than dinner plates. Damn, I'm not sure. The one I'm having the easiest time with is the third one about the microscopic crustacean with more genes than anything than humans. I think humans have, what, 20 to 25,000 genes. And I know we're not at the top of the pile in terms of genes, and it doesn't matter. It's not the amount of genes. It's it's the interactions between them and things. So that one I could buy much more easily than the first two. So I got to pick between the first two. Number one's too obvious, and number two, the carnivorous cricket, is just too out there. I'm gonna go with the lizard vestigial leg. So
yes.
Rebecca, you got your wish.
Yeah, you did retroactively go
yes.
with Bob.
Retro wish. very polite of you, Bob.
Jay?
Saw into the future.
Very chivalrous.
Awesome.
That's definitive proof, incontrovertible proof of time travel. There we go.
Yep.
Jay?
1 second per second.
Well, regarding modern snakes evolving from lizard ancestors, it just seems like ridiculously obvious. Duh, of course. I mean, they share ancestors with lizards, you know? I mean, they're so damn similar, it's ridiculous. I mean, I can't think of any legitimate reasons why they would lose their legs.
I like how you say legitimate reasons. Like maybe they actually lost them in a barroom brawl or something like that.
Through some scam.
All right.
I just think that one's true. A newly discovered fossil that revealed the 100-million-year-old carnivorous cricket that was as large as a domestic cat. That's frightening. I mean, that's crazy scary. Just imagine a cricket that big. I mean, it would jump. It would be able to jump like through your chest. You know what I mean? Like the power in those legs would be ridiculous.
And eat it.
You forget scaling.
But I know that I remember reading things like where they're saying that the oxygen was higher the farther back you go, and then that can support larger creatures.
Didn't I say that?
Yeah, he said he remembers hearing it. Just heard it minutes ago.
I read that, or Bob said that a couple minutes ago. I don't know.
No, scrawled on a wall.
I'm sorry, Bob. While you were talking, like I'm thinking about these things. But I don't know. There's something
you
about
be paying attention to me.
Or Googling.
And I'd also think that I would have heard about this enormously scary cricket before this. And imagine them like rubbing their legs together with the noises they'd make. It'd be deafening, you know. So there's something about that one I'm not too sure about. And then this last one, the water flea with 31,000 genes. It's an animal that has the most genes. Wow. So they're saying that this water flea has more genes than any other animal alive today, I'm assuming. Can you tell me if it's today or ever, Steve?
It's that have been examined. Right.
Okay, so as far as all the animals that have been examined so far, this one beats everyone with the number of genes.
Yeah.
Oh, man, this is where I really don't know this type of information. And I'm going to go with the – I'm going to say that the one about the domestic cat-sized cricket, that I think that one's the fake.
All okay. Right, Jay.
Got an even split here, but you all agree in number three, so we'll start there. Scientists report that the animal with the most genes discovered so far is a tiny, almost microscopic crustacean, the water flea, with 31,000 genes. And that one is science.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yay. So we know that two of you are correct and two of you are incorrect. But this one is science. And yeah, you know, so I think of Bob who pointed out the fact that the number of genes doesn't necessarily have to correlate to the physical size of the creature. Obviously, there's probably not going to be a bacteria, you know, with 31,000 genes. But certainly once you get to multicellular animals, you know, it doesn't really matter.
I think P. Vortex has got 30,000 genes.
No, I don't think so. So this is, yeah, this they basically sequenced the genome of this this creature. This is called Daphnia pulex. That's pretty good. Pulex?
A pulex?
P-U-L-E-X.
I like it.
It's like a puma and a Rolex.
So Daphnia pulex.
Why?
Why does it have so many genes? That's a really good question. Because its genes undergo duplication at about three times the average rate. So it's multiplying its genes
Why?
Over evolutionary time.
What's the advantage of that?
At a greater rate.
Well, adaptation. More, I think it'd give you a great chance at adaptation.
Yeah, it's more genetic raw material.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Why why aren't they masters of the planet?
Right. Well, that's the point.
Maybe
right?
They are, and we just don't know it.
They're like fun mice. Running experiments.
It could be a recent adaptation. Who knows?
Yeah.
Or just there's some quirky, odd reason why it's happening. But pretty cool. Pretty cool little creature. Of course, we haven't sequenced the genome of every living thing on Earth, so it's the current reigning champion, but it doesn't mean it won't be deposed at some point in the future.
You think it will be deposed at some point?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think
just going with the odds.
Yeah, just going with the odds.
Something smaller and more obscure, you think?
Not necessarily.
And Bob, you're right.
Probably not.
Humans have 23,000 genes. You got that? You remembered that correctly? This is 31,000. Yes. So yeah, it's about one and a half times as much. Not too.
Yeah, that was a big deal when we mapped out the human genome. Like, damn, we've got fewer genes than we thought we did.
Yep.
But it turns out that doesn't matter, obviously.
Yeah.
It's not the raw number that matters that much.
All right, moving on.
Okay, so I guess I'll just keep going in reverse order. Number two, a newly discovered fossil reveals a 100-million-year-old carnivorous cricket that was as large as a domestic cat. Bob and Rebecca think this one is science. Jay and Evan think this one is fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Yeah! Evan, high five!
Well done. Nice.
Good job, guys. But this is based on a real news story.
They always are.
Paleontologists have found a 100 million year old carnivorous cricket.
So it is science.
That's science.
It's just not as big as a domestic cat.
The word science.
It's not as big as a cat. It's in fact very similar.
He's a dog.
Very similar to the modern version. This is the splay-footed cricket. And what's interesting about the fossil is that it is almost indistinguishable from its modern-day descendant.
Oh, cool.
So this is a genus of cricket. I mean, there are some differences. It's obviously not the exact species, but the genus is largely unchanged over the last 100 million years.
Wow.
And very successful.
So it's not just successful. It's also probably still in the same habitat. Which is like a dry,
kind of have to be, right? Almost.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So the most common response of a species to a change in its habitat is to do what?
Die.
To,
That's the second mode. That's the second mode.
Get out of town.
Yeah, so it's to habitat track, to move, to find, just to migrate to some place that is as close to the habitat you're already adapted to as possible. The second most common response is to go extinct. And it's only the third most common response to evolve, to adapt to the changes in the environment. Yeah. So clearly this cricket has just been successful at habitat tracking for 100 million years and hasn't had to adapt or evolve at all. It's pretty much the same as it was 100 million years ago. Of course, the creationists always hit upon these examples as evidence against evolution, because they go back to everything should be constantly changing at a constant rate. Well, no, evolutionists don't believe that. That's, it's about a 200-year-old notion, maybe 150 years. So yeah, this is perfectly compatible with our modern concepts of the mode and tempo of evolution, as Stephen Jay Gould liked to say. Cool. But yeah, that was pretty cool.
Jiminy,
but it wasn't as big as a cat. I was thinking, oh yeah, the whole oxygen thing, and there were like the plate sized dragonflies and stuff. So I was trying to push that a little bit.
That
gave it the plausibility. It would be pretty scary though, and it was carnivorous. I mean, imagine seeing a carnivorous cricket as big as a cat. I think that's what I said.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
You totally sucked me into that one, Steve.
I heard that once somewhere.
I don't like you taking advantage of me and manipulating me that way.
All right, which means X-ray studies of an ancient snake fossil reveal a hidden vestigial leg and support the hypothesis that modern snakes evolved from lizard ancestors. And this one is, of course, science.
Of course it's science.
This is cool as well. So actually, there aren't many well-preserved ancient fossil snakes. So we don't know that much about snake evolution because their skeletons actually tend to be delicate. And we have only very partial skeletons, but this is a fairly well-preserved skeleton. So this is actually a very well-preserved species. The article says only three specimens exist of fossilized snakes with preserved leg bones. So this is only one of three fossils showing that they had legs. This is Eupodophis discunzi, I think is how you pronounce it, discunzi. A lot of vowels in there. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. So this is about 95 million years old. And actually, the paleontologists have already seen one leg cropping out of its pelvis. But the leg that's on the top, the surface of the fossil, so that's eroded. And it's not in very good condition. So they used 3D X-ray technology in order to look at the other leg that's still embedded in the rock. So it's better preserved because it's still inside the rock. And they were able to image the complete leg. And it looks very vestigial. It doesn't have any toes. It's reduced in size. But it has, the leg bones, and it's coming off of the pelvis. It's like exactly what you would think a vestigial halfway gone leg would look like. So good job, Jay and Evan. You guys turned it upside down.
Thank you. You flipped it.
Nice.
This time.
Yeah,
Bob and I have to give them one every now and then.
Yes.
To keep their hopes up.
Exceptions that prove the rule.
You got to throw it every now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I love the exceptions that prove the rule. No, it's just data. It's just contradicting data. All right. Well, Jay, you have a quote for us this week?
This was a quote sent in by Jeff Fisher from Columbus, Ohio. And it's a quote from Leo Tolstoy. Rebecca, who is Tolstoy?
Tolstoy is a famous Russian author.
Da.
And he was considered to be one of the world's greatest novelists. Thank you.
Yeah,
he's smart.
Real
girl,
horror
Rebecca.
Show.
He did the War and Peace thingy, right?
Yeah.
What were you looking for? Famous Russian author is pretty much it. Describes it, right?
And he said, the most difficult subjects can be explained to the most slow-witted man if he has not formed any idea of them already. But the simplest thing cannot be made clear to the most intelligent man if he is firmly persuaded that he knows already, without a shadow of a doubt, what is laid before him. Leo Tolstoy!
That's a good quote. I like that.
Thank you.
He's all right, that Leo.
And thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure. You're awesome, thank Steve. You, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Theorem is performed by Kineto and used with permission.